Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we're living one of those moments where virtual unlimited corporate power meets crony capitalism. Some call it fascism. Some call it good business. We're seeing what happens when outweighed corporate power and a government system that, well, bought and paid for it. As I've said a number of times, we do have the best democracy money can buy. This is one of those stories. This should have been the David slays Goliath story. But sadly, Goliath has somewhat come back to life and used, well, our power and our institutions against him. And here to share his story is that should have been that David. I've asked Stephen Donziger to come talk with us. Stephen's an environmental lawyer. You may remember back in the mid-2000s, there was all that stuff around the Amazon and Chevron and Texaco being sued. There's all those lawsuits. This was the guy that was behind it. And that's why I've asked Stephen Donziger to come talk with us. Stephen, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with where you are right now before we go back through this whole incredible story. Right now, I understand you've been locked in your house for, I guess, a year and a half. I mean, all of us have been kind of locked away, but you've got a court that says you got to go, you got to stay home.
Yeah, I've been, this is my 19th month of house arrest without trial on a criminal contempt charge that's filed by a judge that was rejected by the prosecutor's office. It all stems really from Chevron pushing the judge to try to lock me up because of the successful work of our team. You know, my work and the work of other lawyers in the United States, Ecuador, and other countries to hold Chevron accountable for what's probably the worst oil-related pollution on the planet, including the dumping of billions of gallons of toxic oil waste down in Ecuador on indigenous ancestral lands from like the mid-60s to the early 90s. So, you know, the people of Ecuador, the indigenous groups won the case in 2011. Chevron retaliated by filing a racketeering lawsuit against me in New York, and not just me, but all 47 named plaintiffs, the villagers down in Ecuador. They engineered it to a particular judge who's a former tobacco lawyer, industry lawyer. He denied us a jury and basically ran what we think was a show trial where Chevron paid a witness $2 million to come in and claim that we had bribed the trial judge in Ecuador, which is completely false. This witness had been coached for 53 days by Chevron's lawyers before taking the stand. Later admitted lying, has no credibility, and you know, 29 different appellate judges in Ecuador and Canada have affirmed the validity of the underlying $9.5 billion judgment against Chevron. So there, you know, Chevron was trying to really weaponize this trial judge in the U.S. to try to evade paying the people of Ecuador the money they owe for the pollution. Ultimately, you know, we kept pushing forward and won a bunch of positive court decisions in other countries, including Canada, to try to seize Chevron's assets. And at that point, Chevron's New York legal team went back to this judge who had shown animus toward me and others and asked to see my computer and cell phone under really what I think is a bizarre theory that they had a right to look at my confidential case information. And ethically, I couldn't do that, so I appealed that order. And while that order was on appeal and is still on appeal, the judge charged me with criminal contempt and had me locked up. That was in August of 2019. It's a misdemeanor charge. There's not a single other person in the United States locked up even for a day on a federal misdemeanor other than me. In my mind, it's a corporate attack where in this case, Chevron and its lawyers have taken control of a certain segment of our federal judiciary to try to, you know, confiscate my passport, which they have done, prevent me from traveling to do my human rights work, and to punish me and hold me up as a symbol. I'll say this, very important, is the judge, his charges were rejected by the SDNY, the federal prosecutor in New York. So the judge then went ahead and appointed a private law firm to prosecute me in the name of the government. And this private law firm, the name of which is Seward and Kissel, has a client relationship with Chevron. as well as several oil and gas related entities that have ties to Chevron. So I'm basically being prosecuted in the name of the government by Chevron and locked up.
And you go, how is that possible? Because, I mean, to narrow this down into a real simple soundbite, you had a civil court. The civil judge charged you with a criminal complaint that the District of New York wouldn't prosecute. So a private attorney group was brought in to prosecute you, and you've been locked away for a year and a half on something that you probably would have at maximum spent 6 months in jail for. This is unbelievable to me. It's one of these stories that you go, this can't possibly be true. And yet everything I see absolutely is true.
Yeah, it's unprecedented and it's scary because, you know, no matter what you think of the United States of America, we at least aspire to live by the rule of law. And that means that your prosecutor needs to be disinterested, not have a financial conflict of interest. It means the judge needs to be unbiased. And I don't have that in this case. I mean, this is basically, as David Sirota wrote in The American Prospect, this is the first time that the government has given big oil the power to prosecute its main critic. So, you know, this is bigger than me. I mean, I'm suffering. I live here with my son and my wife, my 14-year-old son. You know, it's just ridiculous. And they won't let me out. They claim I'm a risk of flight, like I'm going to flee to Ecuador.
Where are you going to go? I mean, this is your fight. You have, you know, as I was reading through this, and I'll be honest with you, I guess I don't have the kind of intestinal fortitude that you have, because at some point I give up on this. And I think virtually anybody else who's gone through what you've gone through would probably go, enough of this. But this has been your life's work since 1993. You're not, I seriously doubt you're going anywhere.
Well, I'm not going anywhere, and it's a pretext. As a matter of fact, when I was charged criminally by the judge, I was already out of the country, and I came back. So obviously, I'm not a risk of flight. They also imposed an $800,000 bond on me, which was put up by some friends. You know, and I'm locked up. And I will say that the four cops who killed George Floyd, three of the four have lower bonds than me, and they're out right now, waiting trial, free. Many of the so-called insurrectionists, the white supremacists who stormed the Capitol, rioted, committed acts of violence, are out. You know, I won a huge pollution judgment against Chevron on behalf of indigenous peoples, and I'm locked up. Total double standard. And it's really the power of Chevron and the oil industry as exhibited in this case. People need to, you know, awaken and understand that it is, I think it's a dangerous threat to our democracy, our civil society.
You know, as I was reading through your story, and it's an incredible one, and I hope people will look deeper into the work that you're doing. I kept coming back to this thought of, how is it you're not just laying in a field somewhere? You know, how is it they didn't just have you killed? Because we hear those stories everywhere. It seems that would have been much simpler than you destroying our entire judicial system to just prosecute and persecute just one person.
I don't know what to say about that. I mean, you see what goes on in this industry when you really do work that, you know, threatens the interests of it at a core level, which I think this case does. You know, not just because of the monetary judgment, but just because of the idea of this case. You know, the idea that, communities in other countries who are also victims of pollution would, you know, figure out how to connect with talented lawyers in the United States and Canada and, you know, get money. You know, this requires an economic model to raise the money to compete with Chevron, you know, which spends billions of dollars on legal fees. So, you know, they don't like this, the idea, the concept, the paradigm of people around the world uniting, you know, from the Amazon to courtrooms around the world to hedge funds who help, or donors, wealthy donors who help finance this kind of human rights work. They want to destroy the model of the case. They want to kill it off. And that's what they're trying to do here. I mean, I don't think at this point, you know, I don't think they're going to be killing anyone. And I take what you're saying because, you know, there's a lot of human rights activists around the world and lawyers who have been murdered by, you know, for doing environmental defender work. in other countries.
No, the reason I bring that up, Stephen, is I've interviewed people from Colombia who are labor activists. And the stories they tell of being pulled off of buses and shot in the head, having seen people that happen, having seen labor leaders thrown out of airplanes. This is not, we're talking about Ecuador and, maybe not here, but we're talking in places that you've been that you could be pretty vulnerable. So I got to be honest. It's got to be something you've thought about.
Well, I am vulnerable. I mean, I'm 19 months without trial, locked up in my house, and I did nothing wrong, in my view, other than to litigate successfully against Chevron. So,
But here's the thing, Stephen. There's a massive groundswell of support right now. I see, aspiring attorneys and all these human rights groups and all these activist groups who are coming to your defense and to your aid to try and get this overturned, and all the attention that's coming with it. This is growing, and the message is getting out, and that's got to be on some level really inspiring to you to keep this fight going.
Well, it does. I mean, it's solidarity, and I never, of course, you always understand solidarity, but until you really need it, you don't really understand it like I do now. I mean, I've had 55 Nobel laureates have issued a statement demanding my release. 13 major human rights groups led by Amnesty International just wrote a letter to the U.S. Department of Justice demanding that they take the case back from the private law firm and dismiss it. Hundreds, thousands of lawyers around the world sign on to my defense committee. So, I just spoke this week at Stanford Law School, and a bunch of students wrote a letter to the law firm that's prosecuting me, saying they're going to, they organize a national boycott from 52 law schools for students who are refusing to work at this law firm in protest of their unethical prosecution of me. So there's a ton of stuff happening. Judges have lifetime appointments, and they're, one of them is a member of the Federalist Society, which is receives significant amounts of money from Chevron and oil and gas interests, and they just don't seem to want to move on it. I mean, they're just trying to steamroll me, but we have a lot of leverage too, and we're going to keep pushing.
Now, here's the thing, and I look at the work that you and your team has done, it's my view that what you've done is what governments should be doing. Our government should be holding Chevron accountable in our name. We shouldn't have to have Stephen Donziger, put his life into this and then be a political prisoner in his own home. We shouldn't have to do this. We should, through our government, a government of, for, and by we, the people, we should be doing this stuff for ourselves.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the role of plaintiff's lawyers generally in our society is outsized because the government is not regulating our society in the way that it should. So there's a balance between capital and workers, and, there's a basic social safety net. So, when a corporation can pretty much, pick its own judge and, have its law firm prosecute its main critic in the name of the government, that's just really unbelievable.
No, it's something that we expected in a third world country like Ecuador. And as I understand, when you guys started this suit, you wanted, it began here in the U.S. and Texaco wanted to take it to Ecuador, where they then lost. I mean, this is the weird twist of this story for me. They got what they wanted. They were on their home turf and they still lost because it was that bad.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they insisted the case be heard in Ecuador. The Ecuadorian communities wanted it heard before a jury in the United States. Chevron was petrified of a jury, so they accepted jurisdiction in Ecuador just to get it away from a U.S. jury. And once we got to Ecuador, they claimed that they weren't going to accept jurisdiction. So they denied the people a jury in the underlying case. In the RICO case against me, the judge denied me a jury, and now they're trying to deny me a jury again in the criminal contempt case. So, the people going after this case and after me do not like juries for obvious reasons, because once anyone hears the facts, they almost always side with us.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Stephen Donziger, environmental lawyer, U.S. political prisoner over his suing of Chevron and ultimately winning. Here's the thing that gets me. I saw you were featured in the documentary Crude, and as I'm watching through this documentary, you see these horrible conditions and you see these people who are just they're just overwhelmed. I mean, you know, babies with all kind of these bizarre rashes, people with all these cancers. I don't know how you can look at that and go, there's not a problem that this corporation caused. And ultimately, I'll say as well, the Ecuadorian government has a lot to do with this as well, in my view.
I agree with that completely. I mean, you know, and I mean, look, the primary culpability lies with Chevron and Texaco. Ecuador's government made money off of the operation, never regulated it properly. But there was really only one operator in Ecuador, and that was Chevron. The government was a passive investor, and Chevron was the operator because they had the expertise to do it properly without systematically dumping billions of gallons of toxic waste into the environment. There's a lot of responsibility for this, but the primary responsibility is with Texaco and Chevron, in our view, and also the court's view.
Now, you were on the ground there an awful lot. I guess one of the questions I had, did you learn to speak the language because of this case or before this case? Because, you know, as I watched you in this documentary, you spoke the language fluently.
Yeah, I studied Spanish well before I got involved in the case, but, you know, traveling to Ecuador, I've been there over 250 times, and working in Spanish, I learned Spanish. I had to be able to work effectively in Ecuador. But, you know, interestingly, a lot of the client base speak native indigenous languages. They don't even speak Spanish, you know, so one of the challenges when you're an advocate and a lawyer on a case like this is to connect up people from different cultures and different backgrounds. I mean, the gulf can be really wide, you know, so it requires a huge amount of organizing and sort of social skill and emotional intelligence to be able to sort of pull together communities in the rainforest and have them work effectively with, you know, Western educated lawyers from the north. And, you know, I think that's frankly what one of the things that terrifies Chevron is that we were able to pull all that, not just me, but lots of people worked on this, were able to pull this team together. Couldn't have done the case if I didn't speak Spanish.
But here again, I go back to this documentary where some of the images were heartbreaking. I mean, especially these children who, you know, they don't have any opportunity because of the environment in which they live in. And then they hear the executive from Chevron say, oh, well, you know, it's because they don't have sanitation. And to throw it off in some flip manner. I mean, I can't imagine what your eyes have seen. I was heartbroken just seeing what I saw in that documentary.
I mean, you know, my last trip down there, I toured the affected area, and, you know, almost everyone, there's almost nobody who doesn't have some family member who's died of cancer. You have babies, you know, dying of leukemia, like 6-month-old babies. You know, you don't see leukemia in babies, okay? You know, leukemia is a disease that manifests in adulthood, often with people who smoke. So how does a baby get leukemia? I mean, the fact is these people are being exposed, you know, hundreds of times a day to cancer-causing oil waste in their food, in their water, in the air. And babies are particularly vulnerable because their immune system isn't developed yet, but everybody's vulnerable. And if you keep getting exposed over time, you end up, it's likely you're going to get cancer and potentially die. You know, and also there's a real lack of medical care. I mean, there's people who get cancer, say a tumor, and because they can't get to a doctor, the tumor will just grow. I mean, you know, to literally enormous proportions, like a basketball size out of the rib cage of a person, you know, stuff you would never see in the United States or most countries, because people, you know, even if they're suffering, they get treated for these diseases. It's hard to know the precise number, but we estimate thousands of people have died because of this. It's one of the world's, you know, worst humanitarian crises. And because it's happening slowly and incrementally, people aren't like waking up to it. You know, I will say this, when BP had that accident in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010, they immediately put up a $20 billion fund, and ultimately they paid $60, $65 billion in compensation and fines. This judgment we won is $9.5 billion, and it's for a far worse oil spill, one done deliberately. The BP spill was an accident. Texaco and Chevron did this deliberately to save money, and they refused to pay even a penny. And they lost the case. You know, and I think there's a certain, we have to recognize there's a certain colonialism and a certain maybe structural racism in how the courts up here think about Ecuador. You know, Ecuador's Supreme Court and Constitutional Court both unanimously affirmed the judgment, as did Canada's Supreme Court for purposes of enforcement. And the only thing against that is one U.S. trial judge who ruled without a jury based on this, in my opinion, false testimony by a paid Chevron witness. So how does one guy, you know, doesn't really, he never looked at the evidence in the Ecuador case, come up with the decision that a lot of the media in the United States pays more attention to than the collective wisdom of 29 appellate judges in Ecuador and Canada who have validated the judgment? I mean, it's extraordinary if you think about it.
No, it absolutely is extraordinary. But sadly, we're insulated here in the U.S. from the tragedy that you witnessed. That doesn't happen here. And I think your example is a good one, that they spent, you know, an enormous sum of money to clean up what was an accident. But what was decades long of deliberate destruction, nothing.
But you know, it's not like it's costless for Chevron. They've used 60 law firms and 2,000 lawyers.
Yeah, but is it still cheaper to pay the lawyers to go after and attack you? Because here's the thing, and this is where, if they lose in Ecuador, don't they then have to pay everywhere else? I mean, aren't you then setting the precedent for everywhere else where they've destroyed things?
I think they've calculated that to be the risk to them, yeah. I don't think there's that risk. I think that there's a real rational argument for them to pay the judgment or settle the case, you know? But they are, it's almost like they're on a crusade. They are attacking the very people they poisoned with spending, I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars in legal fees on dozens and dozens of law firms, on hundreds of lawyers. If you took all that money that they're paying for all these lawyers, experts, consultants, scientists, and actually put it in a fund to clean up, you'd really be able to do a lot of good for a lot of people, and you would probably save yourself from reputational harm that they're currently experiencing. But it seems to them like this is like war. And I think it has to do with the fact the industry is in decline, you know, and they want to extract every last dollar of profit they can. And the last thing they want to do is set a precedent by paying, you know, indigenous leaders in the Amazon significant funds to clean up the pollution they caused.
Is it possible for the oil companies to get any worse of a reputation? I mean, I don't know, salvaging their reputation is a reason why fighting this. Because I don't think, or at least with most people I know, I don't think you can get a much worse reputation than they have.
Well, I think that's a good point. But I will say that often they will show up in other countries and try to act like good citizens to do deals and get access to supply. So sometimes, you know, being known as a real polluter or known as a company that ignores court judgments can put them at a competitive disadvantage around the world. So while I agree they don't care that much about their reputation, I think they assume it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
No, you know, this kind of stuff can factor into business risk and business decisions.
No, and you know, I remember a year and a half or so ago, I interviewed an author, a guy named John Perkins. He wrote the book Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And, you know, he was talking about going around the world and using the U.S. government to you know, do the bidding of these big corporations. This is right in line with the exact same thing. You've got, you know, the U.S. court system who's protecting these global corporations. And I got to assume they're making huge profit off of it somewhere. There's got to be someone to push back against this. And this is where I'm hoping the movement that you're creating and the people that are in this free Danziger movement will be the ones who shine an even brighter light on this. But again, I look at our political system, Stephen. We're so divided, so broken, that I don't even think if you came out and all of this stuff was dead spot on true, our political system could even come close to fixing it.
Well, you know, you got to try, right? And you know, we're fighting for justice for tens of thousands of people in Ecuador, and also justice for the planet. You know, this is intimately connected to the climate crisis. I mean, if you can't do this kind of work to force companies to clean up their pollution, how are we ever going to, you know, save the planet? So it's all connected. You have to keep pushing, keep trying. I mean, obviously some people suffer, the people of Ecuador are suffering. You know, I'm suffering, my family's suffering, it's hard to watch, but It's happening because we won the case. The Ecuadorian communities won the case. We have to remember that. We cannot let them define what happened here. Okay, the people went to court as they were supposed to, and that Chevron accepted jurisdiction. They presented evidence, 64,000 chemical sampling results of Chevron's pollution of their lands. And a court appropriately applied, you know, looked at the facts and applied the law and found Chevron liable. They won the case. And they can't handle that. And that case has been validated by the Supreme Court of Ecuador and the Supreme Court of Canada. So why do they come back to a trial judge in New York to attack me? Because they don't want to pay that judgment. And they're trying to use it as cover to distract people from what really happened, which is their own, you know, their own guilt, their own culpability for, you know, poisoning the Amazon and really hurting and killing a lot of people. So, you know, we won, our side won, we will keep fighting. Yes, the US government has some structural problems in terms of its favoritism toward corporate power. I mean, we all know that. It's been a slow multi-year process of, you know, of entities like the Koch brothers and others who have really laid out a ton of money to make that happen.
And the Supreme Court.
In the Supreme Court. And it doesn't mean every judge in the federal system is like that. They're not. There are some good judges. You know, there's two judges who got onto this case who I believe are not, you know, complying with their duty to be fair and neutral. That's a really nice way to say it. I mean, there's actually much worse than that. So we have to keep trying. And it's the only thing we can do. But people need to wake up to this. And by the way, can I just say something? People want to help, how they can help?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, there's a couple of ways to help. One is I have a defense fund called DonzigerDefense.com, DonzigerDefense.com, one word, where you can make a donation, or if you can't make a donation, sign on anyway. You can sign on to our campaign. We're getting a growing email list, and every couple of weeks we send out updates about the case, which often contain things of action that people can do to help. So go to DonzigerDefense.com. The other thing is a bunch of organizations are putting out a new video about the case in the coming days and trying to start raise awareness of the need to make me free again. Look for that. And if you see it on social media, please send it around. And you can find me, by the way, I tweet a lot about the case. I'm on at S Donziger on Twitter, S-D-O-N-Z-I-G-E-R. Try to follow me on Twitter. You can get a lot of information about the case.
And we'll make sure we get links out on social media to make sure people take a look at this, and also throw some donations to DonzigerDefense.com, which you see on the screen as well. But, you know, this is one of those moments where I keep coming back to, we shouldn't have to be begging for donations to do what's right, but I hope people will dig deep and help, because this is much bigger than just you, and I think you alluded to this earlier. If they're able to silence you, it's more than just Stephen Donziger. It's about anyone ever going after a corporation ever again. And especially since I brought up the Supreme Court, we have a 6-3 corporate Supreme Court right now that overwhelmingly sides with corporate interest. So if you look at this case and, well, the future that's coming, it's bleak if we allow this to stand.
Yeah, I agree. It's all connected. And you know, we have to fight for our rights. I mean, you know, all advocates, all corporate accountability, environmental justice advocates, indigenous rights advocates, human rights advocates are in play right now, because the playbook they're using against me can be used against anyone else. So we have to really take a stand here collectively. It's very important in my view.
Stephen, I wish you the best. I hope folks will go to DonzigerDefense.com, follow you on Twitter, and help out in any way they can. And I wish you the best, and I hope you'll come back and talk with us again once this is over.
Anytime. Thanks so much, Rick. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks so much, Stephen Donziger. Again, DonzigerDefense.com. We'll get links out on social media. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.